Thank you, Your Honor.
Can counsel both hear me?
I can, thank you.
Okay, good. We're going to have a little demonstration by our Supreme Court Marshal on how we keep time before we begin. If you look at the upper left-hand corner of your screen, you will see when it's time for you to start, a green start card. When you have 5 minutes to go on your argument, you'll see a yellow card that has 5 minutes on it. And when it's time for you to conclude, you will see a red stop card. I will pretty much hold you to that stop card, and I'll help you keep track of it, because I know when you get involved in argument, it's not really what you're thinking of is looking up in the corner of your screen. But if there is a question pending from a justice, or you're in the middle of trying to answer a question to a justice, you don't need to ask me for permission to do that. Just go ahead and finish answering the question. Once you have, I probably will rein you in if you start on a different tact again. So with those little bit of a explanation, I will call our second case of the morning, Eau Claire County Department of Human Services versus S.E. Attorney Aquino, are you ready to proceed?
I am.
Thank you. Please do.
Okay. Good morning, and may it please the court, Tom Aquino for the petitioner, the mother in this termination of parental rights case. So this appeal involves a change in the statute determining how much time a parent has to fulfill the conditions of a CHIPS order before their parental rights are forever terminated. Now, according to the county, the new 15-month deadline for strict compliance began running with the initial order placing the child outside the custody, outside of the family home, which in this case was well before the statute was even enacted. Our position is that the new 15-month time period begins running with an order that includes notice of the 15-month time period. This is the plain meaning of the statute, and it's what the due process clause demands.
Counsel, one of the issues or problems we have in this case is that we don't have in the record the actual dispositional orders that your client was subject to, or the notices that she received as part of those orders. And so we do have in the record just the form dispositional order for protection or services with the TPR notice. And in looking at that, I don't know if we can presume, but perhaps we can presume that the court used the standard form. And it also says in that notice right at the beginning, your parental rights can be terminated against your will under certain circumstances. A list of potential grounds to terminate your parental rights is given below. Those that are checkmarked may be most applicable to you, although you should be aware that if any of the others also exist now or in the future, your parental rights can be taken from you. Presuming that your client received that oral notification from the court and in writing, doesn't that give her sufficient notice that while the CHIPS ground that might have contained the prior statutory language was presumably checked, didn't it give her notice that there could be other grounds, i.e. the continuing CHIPS under the new statute?
Well, no, the statute requires that she be given notice of the applicable grounds for termination. And the grounds for termination in this case that the county wants to apply is the new 15-month, or includes the new 15-month time period. There's a difference between, in the statute that imposes this duty of the court to warn the parent of the of the possibility of the grounds of termination, that's 48.356. It includes notice of both the applicable grounds of termination and the conditions necessary for the child to be returned to the home. So there's the statute's very specific that there needs to be notice, not just of the conditions, but of the actual applicable grounds for termination.
She received that notice, but she was also notified, again, we have to presume based on the form order, that there were other grounds on which her parental rights could be terminated.
Well, I don't think the form can override the statute. You know, the statute says what notice must be given. You know, the form says, you should be aware there might be other reasons, you know, that might be why she would talk to her lawyer or talk to someone else about what this form might be talking about. But what we're, you know, in this case, which, you know, because it was a permissive appeal of a non-final order, we don't have all of the prior CHIPS orders in the record. You know, the question is a narrow one of statutory construction, which is when does this 15-month time period begin? You know, the county's best argument is that, well, the clause that we're talking about, clause 3 of subdivision 3 of the first variety of the continuing CHIPS ground, it doesn't refer specifically to an order including notice of the new 15-month deadline. But neither does it actually refer to any placement order. It simply says if the child has been placed outside the home for less than 15 months, then there's that substantial likelihood the parent will not meet the conditions by that 15-month period. Now, if you look at that in isolation, it just says placed, it doesn't refer to any order. But we know that we're not supposed to just apply the dictionary definition of placement here. Placement has a specific technical legal meaning. It means placement pursuant to an order. And in any CHIPS case, there's going to be multiple placement orders. Well, not any, but many CHIPS cases are going to be multiple types of placement orders. And so the question is, which placement order is the one where you start the 15-month timeline? And so that's why we can't just look at this provision in isolation. We have to look at it in context. And the context of this clause is that the very beginning of this sentence, clause 1 of subdivision 3, does refer to a specific type of placement order. It refers to a placement order listed under subdivision 1, yet earlier in the same statute. And in turn, subdivision 1 requires proof that the child has been placed pursuant to a court order containing the notice required by 48.356. And then when you turn to 48.356, that's the statute that says that these orders have to include notice both of the grounds of termination and of the conditions for a reunion. So when you put it all together, the context of this clause 3, when it's referring to the child being placed outside the home for less than 15 of the most recent 22 months, it's talking about placement pursuant to 15 pursuant to the order including notice of that 15-month time limit.
Hey, counsel, to clarify, it's not enough then that the child is placed pursuant to a different order? I mean, this child was placed pursuant to a continuing CHIPS order that was in effect prior to the change of the statutory, this time frame. Why isn't that good enough?
Because that order did not include notice of the grounds for termination that the county now wants to apply against my client. Okay.
I don't think that what you're saying are grounds. If you look at the form order, and the Court of Appeals got into this, they tried to figure out the grounds are continuing CHIPS. That's what the statute says the grounds are that we're looking at. When you even look at the form, the current form, it says the grounds may be proven by the following proof. So the way you prove the grounds, you want that to be included in the order in order to have it be sufficient, right?
Yes.
Okay, but the grounds are continuing need of CHIPS, and that's why the Court of Appeals got into its discussion of elements of proof, which is, we all live by words in this business that we're in, and elements doesn't quite fit either. But I think what they were trying to get at is that the grounds were continuing CHIPS, and that had to be noticed to her. But the methods by which you prove those grounds were proofs. They weren't separate individual grounds. Could you address that argument? Because that's what I'm hearing coming through on the other side.
Right. Right. So, sorry, I was getting some echo there. The elements, right. So, yes, the statute doesn't define specifically what grounds are. It doesn't mention elements either. It just says that the there must be notice of the grounds. And as you can see from the form, that has, you know, from prior case law, that has included everything that's in the statute. It includes all of what the Court of Appeals called the elements. And I think I think grounds and elements are essentially synonymous as how they're being used, because if there's no, if one of the elements of the continuing CHIPS ground is not met, there are no grounds. Okay. They don't have grounds now. And also,
well, that means they didn't prove that there were grounds. I understand what the Court of Appeals was trying to do. They thought elements were different than grounds, and I can see why they thought that. What I hear you saying is the grounds include all of the proofs that you have to meet in order to prove the grounds.
Well,
right?
Yes. I mean, I just don't.
Whatever see, label you give those.
Right. Things. Well, right. Yes, I think the grounds are the entire subsection that encompasses each grounds for termination. Because the whole point of this is to give notice to the parent about what needs to be proven. And again, and it's not just that there are these conditions that have to be met. It's how much time they have to meet the conditions and what level of compliance is necessary for them to not have their rights terminated. So, you know, again, this, in this case, again, before the change in the law, the state would have to show at a trial that there's a substantial likelihood that in 9 months in the future, the parent still won't be in compliance with the conditions of reunification. And as a practical matter, that means that the parent is substantially complying with their terms. Maybe they've backslid a little bit, but they're making their best effort. They're not 100% making the grade. It's going to be hard for the county to meet its burden. On the other hand, without that look forward position, without that 9 month look forward position, strict compliance will result in a failure to strictly comply with the conditions will result in termination of parental rights.
You know, if I agree with your argument, would we have to start a TPR over every time the legislature changes something like they did in this regard?
No, because, it depends what you mean by starting a TPR over.
Well, that's what we're doing is we're extending it. This little boy has been out of the house for 5 years, right? And, we're fussing about whether she gets a 9 month look forward or whether if she's met the 15 month thing, that's the end of the story.
Right. Well, when the legislature changed the statute, it did not negate the order that was already in existence. It didn't, nothing vacated the order that gave her notice of the applicable 9 month, look forward provision. The day after the new statute was passed, the county could have filed a TPR and just proceeded under the old law. That happens all the time in law where statutes change and a parent or a party is still held to the standards of the law that applied, at the time, before the change. This happens in criminal law all the time. And there's nothing that would have prevented the county from proceeding under the old law. Or the county could have done what the county did in the previous Court of Appeals case addressing this, Dane County v. J.R., which I might have referred to as KT in my brief. I apologize for that any confusion there. But the J.R. case, what happened was the county, shortly after the new change in the law, caused a new CHIPS order to be served on the parent that included notice of the new grounds for termination under the new continuing CHIP statute. And then it waited 6 months, which is what clause one requires. And then it began, then it filed its TPR action. The county could have done that in this case, but it didn't do that. And that's why this case is different from JR, because in JR, the county never took the position that the initial order was the starting point for all of these timelines. They caused the new order that they apparently used as the timeline. So if the new statute is going to create new obligations or change what as it did in this case, create new legal consequences for something that happened in the past, then that is going to be a problem. So in this case, what the statute did was it created this new legal effect to the initial placement order. Under the county's interpretation, if it's the initial placement order that was issued before the statute was adopted, before it didn't start any kind of clock at all. Now it started, according to the county's interpretation, it started a 15-month deadline for strict compliance, which expired by the time the statute was even adopted. So it's going to depend on what change in the TPR statute we're talking about and whether there needs to be I don't think it needs to start over, but there may be maybe in some case a new order issued. It depends on the circumstances.
Mr. Aquino, what exactly are you looking for here? Are you looking for the county to issue a new CHIPS order and then wait 6 months before it files a TPR? In this case, in this instance, are you asking that the TPR start from the very beginning?
So in this case, what we're asking for is a declaration that the 15-month deadline in Clause 3 refers to or begins with an order including notice of the 15-month deadline. That's all we're requesting, is that that 15-month deadline begins not with any placement order, but with a placement order that includes notice of the 15-month deadline.
So then what would have to happen here is that there would have to be a start over, essentially, on this TPR, and the order would have the 15-month deadline, and they could have a hearing, I suppose, and under this current statute, determine that looking forward by the 15th month, she still won't be able to meet the conditions for the return of her child, right?
Well, again, we're a little handcuffed here because of the state of the record and because this was an interlocutory appeal. We don't have all of the CHIPS orders. There are representations made, in the circuit court below that in September or October of 2018 or 19, there was a proper CHIPS order, so issued with notice. So if if that order was, if those were proper CHIPS orders, which I'm not going to concede right now without them being in the record, if they are proper CHIPS orders that include notice, then it would date, the 15 months would date back from then, and those 15 months would be up. That's why the county raised that this in its response to the PFR, that this was potentially moot for that reason. I replied, well, we don't have those orders in the record in any way. It's important that this court address the Court of Appeals distinction between grounds and elements, because that can mean a significant difference in what kind of notice parents are given going forward.
Thank you.
Counsel, you said earlier that context is important in interpreting the statute, and I wholeheartedly agree with you. Part of the context that the court has to take into account, I think, is that unlike many statutes, we have a textually expressed purpose that the legislature lays out at the beginning of Chapter 48. And the legislature has instructed us that in construing this chapter, the best interests of the child shall always be of paramount consideration. The legislature goes on to instruct us that this chapter shall be liberally construed to effectuate the following express legislative purposes. One of those purposes in sub 1 sub A is the courts should recognize the importance of eliminating the need for children to wait unreasonable periods of time for their parents to correct the conditions that prevent their safe return to the family. And both federal law and state law recognize this 15-month period of a child being out of home is sort of it's a somewhat loose deadline because there's other things that we have to take into account other than the child being out of home. We have to take into account the relationship that the child has with his birth mother in this case. But how does your argument account for that legislatively expressed purpose and making the child's best interests paramount and the other legislatively expressed purpose of achieving permanence for the child? Because at this point, I think I lost count, but this child's been out of home for how many months?
It's been, I think it was 2016. So I think it's 4.5 years at this point now. There's several issues that I'd like to address. Now, first off, yes, the best interest of the child is certainly of paramount importance. It's one of the legislative purposes that's enumerated in the first section of the Children's Code. One of the other legislative purposes under 1A is to, quote, preserve the unity of the family by strengthening family life through assisting parents fulfilling their responsibilities as parents. So throughout the Children's Code and in the TPR statute, there's this balance between respecting the parents' right to be a parent, to be a parent to their kid, helping them achieve what they need to do to be a parent to their child, but also balancing with that, that in some cases the parent just is not able to do that, and to if it's in the best interest of the child, then to terminate the parental relationship. The legislature is the one who has to balance that and has done so. Balance the right of the parent with the needs of the child in numerous ways. And the way that's most relevant here is that the kind of notice that must be given to the parent before rights are terminated. It's important that parents get notice of what they need to do, not just to fulfill technical due process considerations, but also to help the parent do what they need to do to keep their child and to preserve that family unit. If they can, do what they need to do, conquer their demons, meet their challenges, then that is for the best. And so the statute does require that they be given notice of the potential grounds for termination.
And that's why I started, counsel, my questioning earlier with the notice that, again, we're making a presumption because unfortunately we don't have the actual dispositional orders in the record, but in my practice, and I know many of my trial court colleagues practice, you use the standard form. And that standard form, regardless of what the statute says, if your client received this notice, she was also put on notice that there could be other grounds for terminating her parental rights. And part of the problem, I think, with your argument are the facts in this case, because this child has been out of the home since 2016. And I agree with you. We have to give proper respect constitutionally and statutorily to the rights of parents. But that's why I asked you about giving meaning to the paramount purpose and consideration that the legislature has instructed us to apply, and that is the child's interests in permanency.
Right. Unfortunately, because of the nature of appellate practice, this case has taken a long time to get here. And it's unfortunate we don't have the record you know, a complete record of what happened below. But, you know, ultimately, you know, the question is what, you know, this isn't the, you know, this isn't the best interest of the, this isn't the disposition hearing. You know, this is a question about what are the proper, what is the law that should be applied to determine whether there are grounds. And I don't know that if the court comes back with a, you know, if the court interprets the statute to say that the 15 month, you know, runs from the initial disposition order at a time when the parent could not possibly have notice of that 15 month deadline. And therefore there it's much easier for the state to terminate the parent's rights. I don't know that that's necessarily in the best interest of the child simply to terminate rights as fast as possible. So
can we reach the conclusion that you're asking us to reach just through statutory interpretation?
Yes. Because
you also give some other arguments which may or may not be as persuasive in terms of retroactivity, which was dealt with also in the JR case. But could we get where you're asking us to go with just statutory interpretation?
Yes, we can with just the structural, the contextual argument, you know, the structural argument regarding how we have in the statute, there are three, the orders are, the law is creating time periods, and it makes sense that they all start from the same time period, which is the order that includes notice of the time period.
If you have other things you want to tell us, you will have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay.
So you can give us some more information at that time.
Thank you.
Attorney McElwam, are you ready to go?
I am.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Eau Claire County Assistant Corporation Counsel Sharon McElwam. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Eau Claire County Department of Human Services. Because this case involves a termination of parental rights action, I will use the pseudonyms assigned by the Court of Appeals regarding the respondent appellant petitioner of Sophie and her son Tyler. Wisconsin Statute 48.415 sub 2, which is Wisconsin's continuing CHIPS TPR statute, was amended by 2017 Wisconsin Act 256. The amendment became effective on April 6, 2018. Subdivision 2A3 of the amended version of the statute outlines what needs to be proved: that the child's been placed outside the home for a cumulative total period of 6 months or longer pursuant to a court order containing the notice required, that the parent has failed to meet the conditions established for the safe return of the child to the home, that the county has made reasonable efforts to provide services to the parent, and if the child has been placed outside the home for less than 15 of the most recent 22 months, there's a substantial likelihood the parent will not meet those conditions as of the date on which the child's been placed outside the home for 15 months.
Counsel, is it your position, you just read what needs to be proved, is it your position that the individual has a right to have notice of what needs to be proved?
No, my position would be that the notices that are customarily attached or actually part of the court orders would be that the notice required is that there is a chance that a parent's parental rights could be terminated based on the various statutes. Whether the statute has changed or not is not the necessary notice. The notice is that this Sophie has been given notice that the continuing CHIPS TPR statute could be applied in her case.
So according to what you're saying, all this needs to say is you should be aware that your parental rights can be terminated based on the following, and list out just abandonment, continuing need of protection or services, and then the third one doesn't apply, unborn child. But that's all. Your position is you don't need to say anything else. You just need to list those grounds, and you could just say what they are and be done. And that's notice, and that's good enough.
Well, my position is that the notice that's been customarily been provided does have the statutory elements in it, but there's no vested right in Sophie having notice of that particular change in the law.
Okay, but I'm trying to parcel this out.
Okay.
Are you saying that, because you just talked about what needs to be proved, are you or are you not saying that that needs to be part of the notice? Or is it good enough that notice is just saying what the actual ground is? So just saying abandonment is a ground. Continuing need of protection services is a ground. Right now it lists, it says as proven by evidence that, and lists out everything, including the time frame in which Sophie has to complete the conditions. Are you saying that's necessary to notice, or let's say this order only listed abandonment and continuing need of services and that's it? Would that be good enough in terms of notice, in terms of the statute and in terms of due process?
I believe as far as due process is concerned, that would be good enough because the provisions are in the statute. Statutes can change by amendments that the legislatures have made to the statutes. And I believe that that notice would be sufficient.
So a parent wouldn't need to be told what they need to do in order to avoid having their rights terminated?
Well, the parent has been told what they needed to do to avoid having their rights terminated.
Well, what written notice is required by the statute, though, correct? 48.415 sub 2, a written order that has it in there?
Correct. And the order... That's key in this under 48.356 as well as 48.417 is the trial court's initial placing order. That order did have notice with all those different elements in there. What I'm saying is that the order has the elements in there. There's not a vested right to the 9-month failure to meet requirement. So Sophie knew that if her conditions of return were not met, that her parental rights could be terminated.
So the time frames are relevant. So the order, it could even change to say we can take your child within 10 days of you not completing your conditions, and there wouldn't be a problem with that according to your argument, because the time frame you're saying is not part and parcel of the rest of the conditions.
The relevant time frame is the 6 months out of home with the notice required. The time frame that is the crux of this matter is whether or not the parent is going to meet the conditions for return in the 9 months after a fact-finding hearing, which is the old version of the statute.
So as long as it's been 6 months, they can go.
Well, the other key is that as was asked in the questions to Mr. Aquino, are that the best interests of the child are paramount in providing permanence. And that's why the trial courts look regularly at the 15 out of the 22 months, most recent 22 months for out-of-home care to be able to move a child toward permanence. It's not reasonable to start any kind of 15-month time frame over again just because of the change of the statute. By that argument, if the statute was amended for some reason every year or every 6 months or every 2 years, you would have to start that time frame over again.
Or go by the current, you could apply the law in effect at the time. You could have applied the law the 9 months at any point here, right? Not gone forward with the 15 out of 22.
That's correct. And our position is that the law that exists at the time the termination of parental rights petition was filed is the law that should apply. There is not a vested right in having the prior version of the statute applied. And according to Wisconsin Statute 990.04, a right of action to be preserved and remain in full force in spite of the repeal or amendment, I would say, in this case, of a statute, there must have been a right of action, and that right of action had to have accrued under that statute. This termination of parental rights petition was not filed till after, well after, the change in the statute occurred.
Thank you. Counsel?
Yes.
I've been blessed with a large extended family, and I take judicial notice that each and every one of my cousins is reasonable. So when we talk in cases about reasonable notice, I think of not just myself, maybe, but the what we refer to sometimes in the law of the wider embraces of humanity. And if there was a notice that said grounds include abandonment, continuing chips, or as the statutes may otherwise provide in the future, I just don't think in a situation as important as termination of parental rights that that's reasonable notice of that the statutes might, or as the statutes may otherwise change in the future. It just doesn't seem to me that that's reasonable notice for all of my extended family. So can you respond to that in such an important occasion? Why is that reasonable?
Well, I believe reasonable notice has to do with making sure that the parents know that their rights could be terminated. And by reading the statute, arguably their rights could have been terminated if in a continuing CHIPS TPR matter, their rights could be terminated after 6 months of out-of-home care with the notice included, as well as the parent not meeting their conditions. To me, that's the crux of this statute. And if they meet their conditions, they never have to get to the predictor or the 9-month failure requirement, because if they've met their conditions, their child should be returned to them.
But isn't it important how long you have until you can have to meet those conditions? And is it perfect compliance or substantial compliance? Isn't that important also?
Well, certainly I think that whether it's perfect compliance or substantial compliance would be an issue for either the court or the jury to decide whether the parent has substantially complied. Before a termination of parental rights petition is filed, attorneys who are going to petition for that have to assess the case to see if the parents have substantially complied with their conditions, if the county has made reasonable efforts, and if the child's been in out-of-home care for at least 6 months with the notice required. That notice starts with the 6-month counting, starts with the trial court's initial removal order.
One follow-up question. Oftentimes, as a shorthand to the TPR statutes, we say it's in two stages, and the first stage focuses on the rights of the parents. The second stage focuses on the best interest of the children, the dispositional stage. The purpose in the statute, a purpose of the statute, is to promote the best interest of the children. Is that what effect, if any, should we give to the purpose of best interest of the children when we are focusing on the first stage, the rights of the parents? Where does the best interest of the children at all influence our interpretation of the provisions that address the rights of the parents?
I believe that Chapter 48, the separate statutory provisions should not be read in a vacuum. They should be interpreted altogether. However, if you're talking about proving the necessary elements that have been alleged in a TPR petition, that solely has to do with the being able to prove those various elements, whether or not they have been met or not. The dispositional phase is where you can get into the best interest of the children. But the reason and especially including if you interpret and consider the Adoption and Safe Families Act, which had influence on the 15 out of the 22 months provisions that are contained in the statute. The focus has to be almost a balancing test where the parents have their right to be able to comply with their conditions for return, to be able to have the child return to their home, but also allow for a permanence if that's not going to happen for the child.
Thank you.
And as has already been noted, Tyler has in this case been out of home care since June 2016. The dispositional order was entered in August of 2016. The amendment of the statute does not, as Sophie inaccurately argues, add a new additional 15 out of the most recent 22 months provision to the continuing CHIPS TPR statute. Those provisions have already been consistently in the Wisconsin statutes in 48.417 sub 1 and 48.365 sub 1 since 2008. And Sophie's distinction regarding removal and placement is not persuasive. The removal of the child from their home happens when the child is placed outside the home by a court order. The initial court, using the 15 months beginning at the trial court's initial removal order is consistent with due process. And it's Sophie has had an extensive opportunity, well over 4 years, to meet her conditions for return to her home. Her argument that the 15 months has to start after an order has been issued with the notice of the new and amended statute is contrary to public policy, taking into consideration the sections of the statute I've already noted.
Can I ask a question about the Court of Appeals decision? I'm looking at specifically paragraph 36 of their decision where they talk about in their view, grounds and elements are different. And they say, about four lines down, each ground in turn has elements. I think I'm at the second or third sentence in paragraphs 36. Each ground in turn has elements. And they're talking about Section 48.415. I promise only to read this one more time. Each ground in turn has elements that shall be established by the petitioning party. But these elements are not TPR grounds themselves. Do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say I agree. But I think that, as Chief Justice Rogensack had stated, it's words. But I believe that the continuing CHIPS TPR statute has provisions under which a parent's rights could be terminated to a child, and the different elements that needed to be proved are the ones that are contained in 48.415 sub 2. So it's kind of a subtle distinction, but I do understand where they were coming from with that analogy.
Counsel, I wanted to clarify something you said earlier. Under 48.356 sub 1, is it your position, and this is the duty of the court to warn, it's your position that the mother, in this case, needs to be notified or warned of the conditions necessary for her to have the child return to the home, that's what it says, but that as part of those conditions, it doesn't include the time frame in which to complete those conditions. Is that what you're saying?
Well, what I'm saying is that the duty to warn has to do with the elements and the various grounds in the termination of parental rights section, which is 48.415. And this is, as has already been noted, this is a permissive interlocutory appeal. So the record isn't complete with transcripts and copies of the various orders that have been given to the parents. So because of the substantial amount of time that this case has been ongoing, which is for over 4.5 years, the parent has repeatedly received notice and known that by the passage of time and her not meeting the conditions, she had noticed that her parental rights could be terminated.
Right. And I'm not talking about, I get that this has been 4.5 years and she may have gotten an order in the interim. And I'm really more concerned, frankly, with the argument that you're making, that this duty of the court to warn pursuant to sub one, and that it needs to be in writing pursuant to sub two of 48.356, that only includes the conditions and it does not include the time frame in which to meet the conditions, because that is really what changed here, is just this potentially forward-looking period. And I know the history, and I actually worked when the Adoption and Safe Family Act was first in place. I'm the one that helped implement it from Milwaukee County out at Children's Court. I am very familiar with it. So, I mean, but putting all that aside, I want to know if you want this court to say the conditions doesn't include the time frame in which to meet the conditions. That seems to pose a big problem to me, well, just in a general sense.
As a general rule, I believe that the notice that is included in the court orders now as a routine practice is appropriate. They should have the various grounds listed on there. And in this case, it would not, if it's the amended version, it certainly wouldn't have the predictor provision in it. I do believe that that's appropriate. That's not what I'm asking the court to say. What I was arguing before is that there's no vested right for a specific provision and specific version of the statute to apply. So I think it's 100% appropriate. I believe that the Court of Appeals case should be affirmed because the amended version of the statute is the only version that existed when this termination of parental rights was filed. The county does not have the authority to look back to try to apply a prior version of the statute because it no longer existed. So I guess I possibly misunderstood your question before, but I do believe it's appropriate for all of those statutory provisions to be contained in the TPR warnings that are attached to orders and are given orally in court as well.
And if you were going to give someone that warning today, what would it say?
Well, it would say what it has said since the statute was amended. It would have, if you're specifically referring to the continuing need statute, that it would say that if your child's been in out-of-home care for 6 months or longer with the by court order with the notice required, that it whether or not the parents had met their conditions for return, whether or not the county has made reasonable efforts to provide services. Because in this case, the child has not been in out-of-home care. The last provision wouldn't apply in my position because the child has been in out-of-home care for longer than 15 out of the most recent 22 months.
Yeah, I asked that. Let me ask it a better way. This has been a new case, and you had someone who had been outside for a cumulative total period of 6 months or longer, and now you were going to give them the notice today, would you have the 15-month notice? Would they receive the 15-month notice?
Well, they would have to, because if you had filed a petition for termination of parental rights when the child has been in out-of-home care only 6 months, they would have the opportunity or the responsibility, so to speak, the county would have the responsibility to prove whether or not the parent would be able to meet the conditions for return within the 9 months it would take to get to the 15 months of out-of-home care. Did I answer your question correctly? Is that what you were asking?
So if I understand your argument, it's that in this instance, Eau Claire did not need to give the notice regarding the 15 out of 22 months because you had already put the other grounds were there. And so she had notice that she had proper notice. And I think in your words, that she had no vested right in having noticed that the law changed. Sophie had no vested right in knowing that and noticed that the law changed. But my question is today, if you're going to give someone this type of notice, wouldn't you be giving them the notice of the 15 month notice? Wouldn't they receive written notice today if you were going to give this same type of notice? You would put the 15 month notice in there, wouldn't you?
I would put the version of the statute that was in effect right now, which would have the provision that if a child has been in out of home care for less than 15 months, then there would be the requirement that the county would have to prove that the parent would be unable to reach the conditions for return within the 9 months following that time. So to get to the cumulative 15-month notice. In this case, Sophie has had notice that her parental rights could be terminated, and any error for not waiting an additional 6 months after she had a notice of the new statute, I would argue would be harmless and cured because there has been a substantial amount of time that has passed since the statute has been adopted.
I wanted to go back to Justice Dalit's question because I understood it, I think, differently than you did, counsel. Justice Dalit can jump in if I'm misstating your question. But I thought she asked you whether the conditions of return of the child to the parent, to the home, includes the time frame. And I don't think it does. The conditions, as I understand them, and having sat on a lot of these cases in the past, the conditions of return are what the parent has to actually do, but not the time frame she has to do them. And again, we unfortunately don't have the orders. I'm staring at the blank form again, but the conditions are set forth in the court's order that we do have in the record under sub 6. And those would be conditions like go to counseling for substance abuse issues, have anger management classes and attend them, write letters to your child if you are in prison and unable to visit with your child. Those are the conditions. The time frame within which the parent has to meet those conditions is something altogether different, is it not?
Yes, I would agree with you. The conditions and the element that deals with whether the parent has met the conditions for return is a much more objective standard and not a speculative one where whether or not a parent could meet the conditions within the 9 months so that the total out-of-home time would be 15 months is much more subjective. And it's hard to predict what the future is going to bring to happen, to bring, excuse me. So I would agree that those are two separate and distinct things that have to be in existence. And whether or not the parents meet if the parent has met the conditions for return at any point in time, which is something that the county needs to assess when they're filing or going to file a petition for termination of parental rights, is definitely a key thing that is involved in the continuing need TPR statute. So, as I've said before, I do believe that Sophie has gotten the adequate notice of the grounds for the termination of her parental rights, and the amendment to the continuing CHIPS TPR statute. She did not have a vested interest in a specific statutory provision for TPR to be applied to her case, and nothing new has been created for her to have to do. The key is the conditions have not been met, and the child has been in out-of-home care, and the reasonable efforts has been assisted with by the county. The amendment to the statute is not a retroactive application of the statute. It's the only version that existed at the time that the termination of parental rights petition was filed. And in order to adequately address the change in the statute, all the provisions of Chapter 48 should be read in unison, because the purpose is to not only protect the parents' rights, but also protect the children. The new law does that. And the change in the law only removed the 9-month predictor feature. It did not require the parent to do anything additional. So the underlying grounds for the continuing CHIPS TPR statute have remained the same.
Counsel, could you just summarize for me, we often write in our opinions, you know, a holding sentence of the applicable law that governs for us. So, and particularly with regarding to the notice issue, that she received proper notice, notwithstanding the change, because, how would you finish that?
Because Sophie has known all along since the dispositional order was entered in August 2016 that the chance that her parental rights could be terminated based on the various grounds, including the continuing CHIPS TPR statute, has always existed, and there is no vested right to the 9-month failure to meet requirement that was contained in the prior version of the statute.
Counsel, I have a question for you, just to tease out this what is ground. So just looking at another ground, looking at, like, let's say abandonment, right now it says the definition of that is that neither parent has been found for 60 days. If that were changed to 30 days, and maybe this is not a great example, but it's the first one that came to mind. But I'm talking about what if something else was changed in another provision? Is it your position that that still is okay in terms of giving notice to the parent? Like, it doesn't matter. It's abandoned. She either is or isn't there. It doesn't matter if the legislature decides it's 5 days. The parent can't be found after 5 days. Does any of this trigger any kind of right to notice, or it just doesn't matter in terms of timeframes?
Well, that's an interesting question, and I'm presuming I can answer it because you started asking it.
Thank you.
Okay. But I think that the law requires notice for a time frame such as the one you described in the abandonment statute that would be shortened. I think it probably would require notice. But what's important to note in the continuing CHIPS TPR statute is that the time frame hasn't changed. The only thing that's been removed is the 9-month predictor provision. Other than that, Sophie's always known that her rights could be terminated if she did not meet the conditions necessary for the return of the child to her home.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Are you ready for a rebuttal, counsel?
Yes, Your Honor. I guess I would start by saying that simply notice that your rights may be terminated is not sufficient notice under the statute. The notice requires both notice of the conditions necessary for the child return and of the applicable grounds for termination.
So, quick question. Suppose the legislature thought 9-month look forward was too long, changed it to 6 months. Is your argument the same, that insufficient notice has been granted and that we need to kind of start from square one on this one?
Well, I don't think you'd have to start from square one. I think that they could still apply the 9-month, okay, under those circumstances, because I think the law would survive it under 990.04. I think, but if the county wanted to instead apply the 6-month, they would have to serve an order that includes notice of the 6-month. They can't just pull the rug out from the parent and say, you know, if they're in month 7 and this, and they haven't complied, they can't say, oh, well, we know we told you it was 9 months, but actually it's 6 months. So sorry, you know, that I don't think is good enough notice. And I wanted to address the retroactivity argument real quick and make clear that we're not making the same kind of vested rights argument that was made in JR. So in JR, they argued that regardless of whether there was an order or notice of the new law, they could not apply the new law because they had a vested right in that 9-month predictor. We're not arguing that. We're not arguing that no matter what, it's always, you know, it's 9 months or nothing. What we're arguing is that our retroactivity argument is based on another definition of retroactivity when a law creates a new legal significance to something that happens in the past. And in this case, it's the county's assertion that the initial placement order starts the 15-month period that makes it, under its interpretation, a retroactive law. But I also wanted to address to the implications in this case of how, as a practical matter, what happens when it goes, the law went from substantial compliance because you could look forward to 9 months versus strict compliance. It's going to change, it will change the parent's motivation if they know, okay, I need to, there's no excuses anymore. I need to meet all the requirements by the, by the time of trial, or my rights are going to be terminated. It's going to possibly change what kind of opportunities are provided by the county if they know, okay, this is, strict compliance is required. It's going to change what kind of advice maybe the attorney gives to the client based on, how the client's doing. Client might be substantially complying and saying, hey, you're doing a good job. I know you've had some, some setbacks, but, keep doing your, if you keep doing what you're doing, you're going to not lose your kids. But that's going to change if instead it's strict compliance, the attorney's going to say, well, no, you need to strictly comply, no more excuses. So there are practical differences to it. It's not just a number. It's going to actually affect how the parent is going to, conduct their lives and approach these conditions. I think I already said that. Just checking my notes real quick. Oh, yes, and I wanted to point out too, and I think Justice Dowlett got towards it towards the end of her questioning about how there are other grounds in the TPR statute that reference these CHIPS orders and these CHIPS placement orders, like the abandonment. There's two different kinds of abandonment depending on whether there are these CHIPS orders in place. If the parent has been continually denied placement because of an order, that's a potential grounds for termination. And so all of those they're highly technical and they need to be disclosed so the parent understands. So again, for the abandonment, the time period, if there is an order, is 3 months versus 6 months if there is no order. So these are significant details that the parent needs to be advised of. It's not good enough just to tell the parent, you know, the subdivision or subsection headings and say that there's a potential that your rights as the parent are going to be terminated. So with that, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. And thank you both for a very interesting case that you presented to us very well. So thank you. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 12:30. We are adjourned.